Chapter 9, The Nutrition Commission, Part 2. Once they had adjusted to their new boss's enthusiasm, the shape of the task, and the urgency of the deadline, the analysts were a delight. After Cleofer and Finn had their first great debate on factor analysis, and Cleofer conceded that he may have been reasoning ahead of the data, well, the whole team settled around him like a ship's crew on a new voyage. An Islander crew, with little hierarchy and much good humor. He had learned a great deal from the pages about the odd corners of the palace, and more from the Better Communication writer's room about their craft. In both roles, though, he had been the experienced one, the bridge to the wider Imperial service for new or undervalued staff. With the analysts, by contrast, he felt utterly at home from the start. Their expertise matched, stretched, and challenged his. Cleofer brought the whole team with him to the meeting where they were due to present their analysis to Lady Angusta and Lord Oriaz. "My lord, my lady," he began, "we have, as requested, analyzed all available data in the palace archives that shed light on the nutritional needs of the people of Solara. We have tentatively identified metrics that indicate changing levels of malnutrition over time, and have formed an estimate of the current gap between food availability, need, and consumption. We have also projected these trends out 5 years into the future, following the advice of the Oranatha on predicted weather patterns and..."
"Thank you, Siom Dong," broke in Lord Oriaz. "All very good, very useful stuff, I'm sure. Thank you."
He nodded to the whole team.
"Lord Oriaz and I have been discussing the purpose of this exercise," said Lady Angusta.
Something in her tone made Cleofer's stomach sink. There were only a handful of days left before she and Lord Oriaz were due to present the findings. She surely couldn't mean...
"The Glorious One is concerned for the safety of his people from starvation," she said. "I believe he will want to see analysis on the risk of famine, not the current levels of malnutrition."
"My lady, do you not think the Glorious One is concerned for the hardships that his people experience now?" Cleofer asked, and wished he hadn't, or at least not so bluntly. The new Solaran aristocracy were not so different from the Astandalan nobility when faced with direct criticism.
"My dear boy," said Lord Oriaz, "the people of Solara are the luckiest on Zunith. There has been no famine since the fall. We do not need to scare up ghosts to fight. We need to present the Emperor with plans that ensure we never need to worry that his people will starve."
Cleofer felt a stir behind him. He didn't dare turn his head to meet any of his team's eyes. "We estimate as many as 30 of 100 households in the docks area may be skipping meals on a regular basis," he said instead. Lady Angusta actually laughed.
"Oh, yes, if we grant your assumptions," she said. "But missing a meal here and there is hardly the same thing as starvation, is it?"
"There is a table on the second page showing the number of deaths." Lord Oriaz slammed his cane down hard enough to make Cleofer jump.
"The Glorious One needs to know that we will do our duty to prevent famine," he said briskly. "Your work is excellent, Siom Dong, but it is beside that point."
Cleofer felt his hackles rising, but what could he do? He was sure the Glorious One would want to know that children were going to bed hungry, were suffering ill health due to their hunger, even in bustling Solara.
"We can extend our analysis," he said, when he had mastered his tongue. "We can show how various pressures might threaten the food security of the city."
He could see both ministers relaxing as he spoke. They had various ideas for disasters to model: war, plague, the further fracturing of time. It was, in truth, an important exercise, preparing Solara to meet any eventuality. It just wasn't the exercise that either minister had originally asked them to carry out. And they only had 5 days, and 2 of those were rest days. Back in their requisitioned meeting room, Cleofer took a deep breath and forced himself to meet the team's eyes. "I'm sorry," he said. "That was not what I expected. The ministers are right, though. Your work is excellent." They sat down together and took stock of the scenarios that Orias and Angusta proposed. Cleofer was confident he could produce some scratch versions in the time available, but when he tried to send the rest of the team home at a reasonable hour that evening, they all refused to go. "We can do this properly," said Finn, "if we dig in." "It's for the Glorious One," said Gerpal, bright-eyed. "We can include all the relevant context, can't we? Please?" It was her work that gave Cleofer those facts about the households near the docks. Looking at her enthusiasm, he could hardly force her to leave. It occurred to him, as they worked through the scenarios, that including the possibility of magic failing would have been high treason in Astondalus the Golden. He mentioned this to Gerpal. She shrugged and said she had been born after the fall. This gave Cleofer a few moments of dislocation, a sense of a shift in the rhythms of the world. The thought jangled, not because of her age, which had long since ceased to be a useful way of reconciling life histories, but because of that strange innocence. A whole generation, many generations in some places, growing up without the Empire, assuming from childhood their right to question the magic of Astondalus. They deserved more than this broken world, than this squabbling mess of a government. Gerpal deserved better. He wished, briefly, powerfully, irrationally, that he could provide a better zenith for her to work at improving. 3 days and nights in a river of coffee later, they traipsed back to meet the ministers. Again, Cleofer had attempted to send his team to bed, but none of them had agreed to go. He thought he was braced for anything. Lady Angusta's opening words proved him wrong. "We have been thinking," she said brightly, and held up a copy of the first report the team presented. "You made some excellent points, Siam Dang. The Glorious One surely does want to know that his people in Solara are flourishing."
"Within reason," said Orias.
"Yes, within reason," she agreed. "We know, sadly, that there is some level of deprivation in all big cities. We need to show the Glorious One how Solara compares. To Hyon City, to the City of Emeralds." Cleofer, feeling rather like a man caught in a current, said,
"Ministers, with respect, only a day and a half remains before the Nutrition Commission report is due to be laid before the committee."
"Time is a bit tight," Angusta conceded, "which is why Lord Orias and I have asked our offices to draft this report. All we need is your evidence to support our proposals, and it's ready to go." Cleofer took the report, hands trembling a little with shock, disbelief, unfocused rage. It snapped into focus as he skimmed the summary. The minister's offices had drafted a polished, practiced paper that argued that Solara was the most fortunate city on Zunith, no doubt due to the beneficent presence of the Glorious One, and that fewer families went hungry near the palace than anywhere else in the world.
"No," he said. "What?" said Lord Orias. "No what?"
"No, we can't provide this evidence. Ministers, we do not have the comparable data for other cities in Zunith. We would simply be guessing and elevating our guesses by attaching numbers to them."
"Siam Dang, this report is going on the desk of the Glorious One himself," said Lady Angusta, smiling at him. "Surely you can put in a few extra hours?"
"Lady Angusta, this team has been working around the clock since the last time you and Lord Orias changed your minds. They have gone above and beyond any reasonable expectations, and without sleep to produce the scenario modeling you requested. We could only do that because we had enough information to repurpose. The reason we cannot produce a comparison between cities is that we do not have the data. The only extra hours that would help would be travel hours around Zunith to collect it. Have you crossed Zunith since the fall, my lady? I have. And I promise you that even with the best couriers on the known routes, we cannot get information back from the City of Emeralds within the month. It is physically, even magically, impossible.
Lord Oriaz looked slightly abashed, but Lady Angusta's smile did not falter.
Can we not just make additional assumptions, as you did in your first draft? She asked.
My lady, we had something to support those assumptions. You cannot want us to send up wild guesses to the Lord Emperor in the guise of evidence. You can have no data or you can have fake data, but neither will come from me.
He heard someone behind him breathe out in what was almost a sigh, and saw Lady Angusta's face change as she realized that he was serious.
Sayo Mdan, the Princess Indrigan is expecting to see this report for clearance in 2 days' time. You know how she is about evidence.
He did know, from long experience,
how the princess regarded those who presented thin or speculative evidence as if it were robust. She would not be happy with any of them, but she would certainly prefer to see this mess for what it was.
My Lady Angusta, he said firmly, I would be delighted to share with Princess Indrigan all of the very substantial work that we have produced, and to explain our process and reasoning.
Cleofer bowed stiffly and walked out. His team, every one of them, walked with him. There was an awkward silence in the meeting room. Cleofer was not, he found, actually embarrassed or sorry about his behavior in the slightest. To his surprise, neither were any of the analysts. Finn thanked him with an unexpectedly profound and correct formal bow.
You have no idea how long I've been waiting to hear someone say no to Lady Angusta, was all they said.
Tiny and mild-mannered Gurpal, whose comments over the past 2 weeks had all been presented with a delicate hesitancy, was positively gushing.
That was so satisfying. Did you see the looks on their faces?
I hope this, doesn't cause any problems for you, Cleofer offered.
Finn shrugged.
It'll blow over, they said.
The analysts were, Cleofer reflected, too valuable to sack, if not apparently valuable enough to listen to. He thanked them again and made sure that, between them, they had a full copy of the notes to be written up for the archives. Then he went back to his room, shut the door, sat down at his desk, and dropped his head into his hands. After a moment, he opened his writing folder, pulled out the, now somewhat crumpled, notes from the Emperor. The two Sun and Glory seals winked at him. Part of him was still wondering, forlornly, why it was so difficult to get anything done. Another part of him was kicking himself for missing everything that was wrong with this commission, for believing that simply being right and well-informed would lead to success. The heat of his initial response began to ebb, but the outrage did not die away. He was fairly confident that both Lady Angusta and Lord Oriaz genuinely thought they were doing what was best for the Glorious One. They had simply not thought through what they wanted, not until it was too late. And ministers were, after all, busy people. Each of them had responsibilities that stretched across the entire world, with thousands of staff members spread across Zunith to manage, and no doubt dozens or even hundreds of projects running at any one time. They still should have paid attention to this one, though. The notebook that he had been scribbling in was still sitting out on the desk. He opened it and reread the last few pages, his attempts to express what it was about this commission in particular that was inspiring and emblematic of the true purpose of government as he understood it. He liked wrangling numbers, certainly. He had studied statistics and history at university, and at one time thought he might be an accountant. But that was not the attraction. It was easier, perhaps, to think about the lives and concerns of people who lived nearby in Solara than to extend his analysis across the whole world. It was more solid, more real. But that was not the attraction. This had been a commission from the Glorious One himself, or at least encouraged along by active interest from his Radiancy.
That had been part of the thrill, and was definitely part of the disappointment. The thought of his work, his summary, going up through the golden trays, carried by the guards into the imperial apartments of the sun on Earth himself to, well, skim over it and ignore it, probably. Even so, his work before the Lord of Zunith, be it under ever so many other names. But that was not the heart of it either, as bitterly as he regretted missing the chance. No, this had been meaningful because it was about getting the evidence that the government needed to intervene to prevent poverty. And that was true, even though he should have known from the start that old Ostendal and Aristos, like Lady Angusta or Lord Oriaz, would not see the baseline level of hunger in Solara as a crisis to be solved, but as a regrettable reality of living in the city. And that was the great insight, the great heart of his understanding of the purpose of government. It was not inevitable that anybody should starve. If some were starving while others lived in plenty, that was not a comparably acceptable outcome. That was a crisis. Suddenly, full of energy, he got up to stalk around his room, the movement helping him think. There were enough supplies in Solara to feed everyone in the city. If he were someone else, if he were Fitzroy Angersoll, the great outlaw poet, he would sneak into the palace and steal the food and give it to the poor. Cleofert M'dang was no Fitzroy Angersoll. Cleofert M'dang had the kind of brain that followed that thought with, yes, but what then? Break into the palace, upend all this jockeying for position, throw open the doors so that everyone could come and take what they needed, and the palace would be ransacked. Fair, perhaps. The emperors of Ostendalus had freely stolen from five worlds. So much art and beauty would be destroyed or seized or broken up for resale. Just the mage lights from this one corridor. Lovely things from one of the great Vunran pottery workshops, imbued with touch-sensitive magic, had been worth someone risking all the penalties of treason, for theft from the palace would be construed as theft from the Glorious One himself. Cleofer had reported the theft, and then regretted it when he reviewed the rotas, and realized the most likely suspect was a woman in the cleaning staff, whose son was known to be desperately ill. And yet, destroying all those lamps was taking irreplaceable beauty out of the world. And yet, that young man's life was worth more than pottery. There had to be a better way. A way for the whole world to work that didn't accept destitution, that didn't lead to a community imploding or impoverishing itself, or smashing the very systems that made it function. His ancestors had faced these problems when they voyaged across the wide seas. In the face of the open ocean, they had chosen to share their resources, to pool their labor and their time and their ingenuity, to beautify each island they claimed and make it flourish. The government of a world, or an empire, was not the same as the organization of one ship for voyaging, or of one village for living well. The systems that governed the worlds were more complex and less comprehensible than the networks that kept an island humming. But the principles should be the same. If only he could work out what that meant. He sat back down, feeling exhausted and not a little foolish. It was not as if there was anything riding on his answers to these questions. However far he perfected his plans for a better world, he would never have the power to implement them. Nevertheless, he cleaned the nib of his best pen, turned a page, and wrote in his clearest hand, "The purpose of government is to steward the resources of all for the benefit of all." He knew, looking at the words, that it would be the study of a lifetime to understand what they meant. Chapter 10, Interlude 3. The homesickness waxed and waned. It was easier when Cleofer could absorb himself entirely in work, shut out any thoughts of yesterday or tomorrow, and just focus on the problem at hand. It had been easier in Princess Indergun's office, working 16-hour days, when she was holding the good order around Solara together from sheer force of will. He shouldn't miss those days. Things were better now that the Glorious One was awake. He did, shamefully, deeply, miss the urgency of disaster response, the full-tilt energy of being part of the Minister-in-Chief's private office.
The work of the pages was no less valuable. The art of government communication did deserve to be taken seriously, and he had helped build a useful agency there in spite of Lord Leofric. His team's nutritional needs analysis was published as an annex to the report developed by Lady Angusta's office, and if his more radical conclusions were omitted in the text, they were available in the data for anyone who cared to look. It was not enough. He started writing home again, though he knew as well as anybody that the state of the post was doubtful. A letter to his mother to assure her of his safe arrival in Solara, letters to Bertie and Toucan, and, painfully, Gilly, bright with a cheerfulness he did not feel. He let his heart spill over, just a little, and wrote in hypotheticals about the world he would like to see. He wished he felt safe enough for specifics. He wished he could sit down with his friends and talk frankly about his struggles with Lord Oriads and Lady Angusta. It would be folly to put criticism of the ministers in his letters, and what he would like to write about the Master of Offices would scorch right through the paper. Some of his views on Princess Indergund were equally unscribable. He was not a rebel poet to immortalize their foibles in excoriating verse. He was a fifth-degree secretary, who did not even dare discuss the situation openly with those he knew best in the palace, who kept his speculations on corruption and conspiracy close to his chest for lack of evidence. The more he antagonized Lord Marylow, the less safe it would be for Syahassia in particular to befriend him. Keeping her at arm's length naturally meant some distance from Kiri and Syamapa, too. He was careful not to attend their weekly lunches more than once or twice a month, doubly careful not to let his wistfulness show, as they dropped formalities with one another, but not quite with him. He calculated how long it would take him to return to the Vongovive. Even if he saved up all of his annual leave for years, and had enough days to get there and back, and spent bare weeks in Gorjo City, he would still be absent for too long. He started saving the leave nonetheless. Perhaps the roads would improve. Chapter 11. The Minister Without Portfolio. And that, my lord, is why I will not accept a further appointment unless it is clarified which minister is responsible for the program of work. Cleofer bowed a respect he did not feel. The Master of Offices looked, for once, a little taken aback. "My dear Syomadon," he began. "I am, of course, willing to explain my reticence in this manner to Princess Indergund directly," Cleofer added sweetly. "I'm sure she will be interested as it relates to a proposal that the ministers are bringing forward for the sight of the Glorious One." Lord Marylow was very still. Cleofer belatedly realized that his very bluntness had the man trapped. There were no suitable responses in the courtly formula for interruption that did not involve deference or threat. And, of course, rubbing the bridge of your nose in exasperation was entirely impermissible, though Marylow looked as though he wished it weren't. The Master of Offices resolved his dilemma by dismissing Cleofer from the room. The next morning, one of the pages brought him an appointment slip for a position as undersecretary to Lady Kuyulush, a minister without portfolio, but apparently attached loosely to the household of the Emperor, in his role as Lord Magus. The page could offer nothing further bar the directions to Lady Kuyulush's rooms, which were placed high and central in deference to her noble birth. Mystified, Cleofer donned his robes, tucked his folder of writing materials under his arm, and trekked through the splendid corridors toward the center of power. Up here, the ceilings were grander, the art on display finer. The luxurious benches were provided so that those waiting for attention of a lord or lady could sit in comfort to contemplate their self-importance. Cleofer reached Lady Kuyulush's doors before the third bell of the morning. Her aide led him into the anteroom, looking dubious. "This seems to be in order," he said, checking Cleofer's slip against a matching one that he had apparently only just received. "Wait here, please." Cleofer sat slowly, taking in the space. The room was furnished in gray so pale as to tiptoe up to white, without ever quite crossing the line into using the imperial color directly. The style of the furnishings was old-fashioned, with thick drapery framing the windows and a deep, soft carpet underfoot, swaddling the room as if against the winter cold that Solara never experienced. There was a small desk, which was evidently the aide's domain, as he returned to it in short order and busied himself with making a note. Even on Nastandalas the Golden, the rest of the furnishings would have looked decidedly fussy, Cleofer thought. With an array of little low-padded chairs and tables heavy with dried flower arrangements, the air was full of the sweet musk of the dry vegetation. Time passed. The aide glanced at him now and then. Cleofer felt obscurely that to make a fuss would be to lose whatever game the Master of Offices was playing now, and held his peace. The bells chimed the quarter hours. The bright sunlight moved across the table in front of him. Self-consciously, Cleofer kept his spine straight, his folder sitting across his knees, his hands loose on top of it. He was conscious that his last three postings had ended awkwardly. Each one was defensible. They had been temporary appointments, small shipwrecks. He knew how to pick himself up and start again. It would be embarrassing to lose this role before he had even started it. Harder to explain to Princess Indigen than any of his mishaps so far. He did not want to have to explain himself to Princess Indigen again. Sometime after four bells, the inner door opened, and Lady Kuyulush made an entrance that could only be described as magnificent. Cleofer was practiced enough in courtly etiquette to come to his feet, and alert enough that he did not quite drop his writing materials, or even fumble with his folder. The lady was tall, square of shoulder, dark of skin, and gowned in an exquisite flurry of ruffles and lace that swished dramatically as she swept in, and put him irresistibly in mind of a frothy cocktail. "My darling," she exclaimed, when Cleofer explained who he was. "An undersecretary of my very own. What a treat. What tiresome robes you're wearing. That color doesn't suit you at all." With some difficulty, Cleofer managed to convey that the robes were a uniform, and that he was here to support her in her ministerial role. Lady Kuyulush was briefly perplexed, and then greatly amused. "Oh, of course, I am a minister. I had forgotten." "What is your remit, my lady?" "Remit?" she asked with a laugh. There was a bitter note to it. "I'm amusing. I amuse." She spread her arms, striking a pose. Cleofer was immediately struck by familiarity. Saya Ulinor, the retired opera singer, had kindly shown him something of her stagecraft. "And what," he asked carefully, "would you have your undersecretary do?" She looked him up and down critically, then sniffed. "Oh, if you like, you can come with me," she said with an offhand shrug. "It will give the chatterers something new to discuss." Lady Kuyulush traveled with a retinue. Three people appeared, disconcertingly silent on their feet, before Cleofer had done more than pick up his folder of notes. He found himself walking alongside her aide, who was giving him bristling sidelong looks, and in front of two identically dressed maids. All four of them followed as the lady swept along the corridors. Every part of the Palace of Stars was beautiful, of course, but the difference between these spaces and the offices and rooms kept for career bureaucrats was striking. Cleofer felt the effect of the grandeur and inwardly fumed. It was clear enough that Kuyulush's ministerial position was entirely meaningless to her and valueless to the government of Zunith. It was equally clear, crystal clear, clear as the Bay of Waters, that she had nothing worthwhile for him to do. The Master of Offices had struck on a happy solution for his problem appointee. Anger boiled in his belly, and he worked to keep it from showing on his face. This was the court proper, not the imperial service, where his ability to wrangle data tables made him valuable. Many of the courtiers were de facto rulers of their own little domains, and the Pax Estandalitis shattered with the Empire. He was unsure how far a tenuous connection to Princess Indigen would protect him. It was fortunate that the corridors were so long. The walk gave him time to rebalance, to remember the most fundamental lesson his Buder Tovo taught. Look first, listen first, questions later. Lady Kuyalush's business that day was social. She attended a luncheon given by the Lady Astrid, in the Eleanoral style, and attended by those parts of Salarin High Society whose background appertained to Eleanor. Their host invited the whole glittering party into the next room to spend the afternoon playing Eleanoral-style card games. There were perhaps 30 aristocratic guests, and at least twice as many assistants and followers. Cleofer was familiar enough with the way that the Ostendalen nobles enhanced their status by surrounding themselves with servants and dependents, but he had never seen a palace party from this perspective. He would have much preferred to wait in the serving rooms with the maids, or stand at the side with her aide, but Kuyalush drew him alongside her, into the throng. Cleofer had learned a great deal of etiquette for the entrance exams, which had not been relevant in his early junior days, and which had then again not been relevant following the fall. In his dun secretarial robes, he was afraid that he stood out like a crow in a pack of parrots. He felt unbelievably out of place and awkward. He could barely manage the formal gestures as deployed in the imperial service. He bowed again and again, murmuring the polite greetings, doing his best to perfect the angle of his back, his neck, his hands. He reflected, as the sides of his face ached with the effort of maintaining the proper expression, that he had only ever interacted regularly with aristocrats in the midst of a world-shattering emergency. There were others mingling who, like him, were wearing uniform or subdued clothing, and shadowing a noble. He tried to mimic them, standing a little to the left and half a step back from Kuyalush, so that she could choose whether or not to explicitly include him in the conversation. After a while, the patterns began to make more sense. It was a dance, and he was, after all, highly trained as a dancer, if very much out of practice. There were some people who made fixed points, centers around whom others circled. Their host, Lady Astrid, naturally, as each guest in turn went over to pay their respects. The delicate and beautiful Lady Oriana, who was only in her teens, but stood in the succession for one of the great princely houses. The priest of Solaris, a member of the senior council of the Orinatha, whose silver robes glittered with tiny bright flecks of possibly magic or possibly mirror shards caught in the fabric. Lady Kuyalush was a supplicant rather than a center here. Cleofer followed her as she orbited each of the favored ones, observed the bright, slightly biting humor she used to draw a quick smile from each in turn. She did not introduce him, but from a couple of sidelong references, he gathered that he was an effective prop to remind the others that she had a ministerial post, whatever that counted for in the game. "Why do you do it?" he demanded later, as soon as they were back in the relative seclusion of Kuyalush's anteroom. His tone was not deferential. The rest of her retinue turned to stare at him. One of the maids actually gasped out loud, and then covered her mouth with her hand. The lady stilled and raised one perfectly groomed eyebrow. "Do you know, Cleofer, darling, you are most deliciously barbaric," she said. "I fail to see how the insult is relevant," he replied hotly. "And now you're trying to shock me into dismissing you," she said cheerfully. "Oh my." She flicked her fan up, as if cooling an overheated brow. "Was it so terrible?" "I am a fifth-degree secretary, my lady," he replied, as calmly as he felt able. "Not a new gown to display to your rivals." Kuyalush straightened slightly, letting the fan drop to her side, centering her weight, her face serious. "Cleofer," she said, and all teasing had dropped from her tone. "I don't know what you did to earn Lord Marylow's enmity, but it must have been spectacular. I bought my ministerial role fair and square. I can see you bristle, dear Emperor, but you need to learn to guard your expressions better, Cupcake. Do you really want to put yourself straight back into his hands?" Cleofer hesitated, knowing he was off balance. He had listened first, looked first, but he had still managed to ask the wrong question at the wrong time. "I thought not," said Lady Kuyalush. She peeled off her gloves, handed one to each maid, and made some small gesture to her aide that was almost too subtle for Cleofer to make out. As all three left the room, she sank down onto one of the small overstuffed chairs and waved him into another. Sitting down took some of the tension out of the conversation and forced him to pause before he responded. Cleofer recognized the tactic. It was a favorite of his Uncle Lazo's. He tried to put aside his anger at being landed in this ridiculous situation, his frustration at the waste of public funds on court fripperies, his resentment of being managed. Underneath those emotions, he found the thread of fear. He knew Kuyulush was right. He was nowhere near good enough at managing his expressions, at sending the right messages in this alien world. He shut his eyes briefly and reminded himself that this was hardly the first time he had been lost in a strange and dangerous land. The courtiers might be beautiful and deadly, but so was a poison dart frog, or a gorge in the gray mountains, or even a typhoon in its way. "What do you want with me, my lady?" he asked, his voice more controlled. "I am service-trained, not a courtier. What can an undersecretary do for you?" "Better," said Kuyulush. "Less accusatory, but still leaving yourself open, exposing too many weaknesses. You must avoid giving me any reason to take offense. But it is hardly necessary to imply that your skills are insufficient, or that there is nothing that you can offer." Cleofer looked at her in frank astonishment. Lady Kuyulush was slouched back in her chair, long legs crossed delicately at the ankle. She was smiling with what seemed to be genuine fond amusement, eyes crinkling. "And the answer, of course, is that I don't want you. I didn't ask for a secretary, but here you are, and this is the hand I have to play. I can tell you come from a culture that prefers open dealing, Siom Dong. So I will be blunt with you. I came to Astandalus the Golden 20 years ago now as an actor. Let's call it that, my dear. It's the done thing. And I was young then, and ambitious, and I found myself a noble patron. Several, in fact." Her face softened in reminiscence. "I came to know the palace well, and I visited often. On the night of the fall, I was taking a quiet dinner with a friend. We had slipped away from the great Silverheart parties early to refresh ourselves, and so..." She shrugged. "You came to Zunith with the palace." "Naturally. And my friend was old and infirm, and his family were lost on Isthar, so that I was all he had. And these apartments, of course. The records were lost, and I look plausible, so he passed me off as his daughter." She laughed, again with that bitter edge. "I thought it was an astonishing chance. I had no idea, no way of knowing then what a trap this gilded mausoleum can be."
"So, your friend?"
"He died," she said, making an ambiguous gesture that Cleofer was sure a true courtier would be able to read. "I inherited. Or rather, I have been impersonating an Astandalan aristocrat for nearly a decade.
We were wealthy. In useless things like gold and jewels. I haven't sold more than a tenth of the heirlooms, you know."
Her voice wavered as if she were slightly drunk, as if this were a sentimental moment between friends. She had just told him a deadly secret, if true. Cleofer felt the prickle down the back of his neck.
"Lady Kuyulush, why are you telling me this?"
"Ah," she smiled, sitting up and easily shredding the lazy drunk pose. "You have some sense of self-preservation, at least. Good. So you know what will happen if you repeat this tale."
"If I, a mere secretary, imply that one of the great ladies of court is an impostor?" Cleofer asked, his throat dry.
"Precisely," she said. "And if you are a spy, well, I do not think you are a spy for Merylow. Why would he waste the effort? I paid him well enough. Princess Indrigan hardly cares for the likes of me, and who else would make use of the Imperial service? The Ordinatha, of course, have their magic." This time, when the silence fell, she waited, her eyes on Cleofer. He did not think he had imagined the slight, very slight, extra challenge in her voice. He thought of the High Priest of Solaris in his glittering robes, of the bribery, the manipulation of appointments, the slow bureaucratic struggle for the levers of power. Lady Kuyulush could break him with a word. She could report him for any crime. She could destroy his career, or would have been able to, had he not already imploded so spectacularly all by himself. She could have him executed. His heart was beating a little faster, but he had never been able to resist a challenge. He met her gaze, squared his shoulders slightly, leant forward. "Do they?" he asked. Kuyulush relaxed back into a laugh. "Ah, there it is," she said. "And who do you work for, Sayo Undang?" He gave a rueful smile. "I'm nobody's spy," he said. "I'm a member of the Imperial Service, currently assigned to your office, my lady, because I refuse to bribe Lord Marylow, and he believes that Princess Indrigan will not let him dismiss me." She stretched, like a cat who has caught sight of a treat and is preparing their whole body to enjoy it. "My dear Cleofer, you are so utterly ridiculous that I am forced to accept that you may indeed be an honest man. How utterly delicious." Chapter 12. The Minister Without Portfolio, Part 2. Lady Kuyulush spent a good half an hour decanting Cleofer's memories and observations from the Alanoral luncheon. Her questions were sharp, despite her mannerisms, and he did his best to answer them objectively and briefly. She sent him away before preparing for evening court. "Cupcake, I do not throw ducklings to crocodiles. Appearances aside, I am not entirely wicked. Attend me tomorrow at noon." Her aide walked to the door with him, possibly entirely for the opportunity to give him a dirty look as he left the room. Cleofer returned a minor nod of his head, conscious that he had dramatically superseded the other man's position in the household, and not really able to do anything about it. He strolled back through the glorious corridors, and out through those that were merely grand, and further out through covered walkways. Still clutching his writing materials, he stepped into the heavy warmth of a Salaran evening, in the high, dry season. Dusk had fallen, but most of the palace gardens were alight with flickering magic lanterns. This was not the way back to his room. He kept walking all the same, listening to the gravel crunch underfoot, exchanging nods with the guards about their rounds, admiring the chance clusters of leaves or branches illuminated by the lights. The warmer brightness of Solara itself spread out like glowing embers raked around the palace walls. Some parts of the garden were dark. Some of those darknesses were haunted, or twisted in time, or both. Magic had worked erratically since the fall. Many routine functions had gone entirely astray, like old mole down in the pages' hall. Others, like the mage lights in the palace, were merely mostly sound most of the time. There was a pattern to the magical effectiveness, and it was so big and simple that it was difficult to see. The small magics worked by Lady Giovanni and her court mostly held. They had attended to practicalities, like the palace lighting and kitchens, but had not attempted to replace complicated constructs like the sorting machine. Similarly, the Lord Emperor was reputed to be adept at small magics, and these also held. The great magics of the Empire, worked by the Ordinatha, had disintegrated utterly but unevenly. There were stagnant pools of sour magic in some places, and stretched or smashed fragments in others. The small magics worked by the Ordinatha were not much in evidence. The priest wizards were working furiously to establish themselves, and if they had reliable magic, they would be using it. Instead, they were, for example, bribing the pages to carry messages to them first. They were seeking mundane power for itself, but also to cover the lack of mystical power. A weakness, but not one that Cleofer was in any position to reveal or exploit. Lady Kuyulush shared his suspicion, but she had given no sign of what that meant to her. Cleofer was inclined to doubt her tale, but not so much her character. She had revealed layers of deception as they talked. It had had the no doubt intended effect of encouraging him to trust her. Slightly against his better judgment, he did trust her. Not so much to tell him the truth as to be benevolent, perhaps. as long as she found him more entertaining to pet than sacrifice, at least. He could feel a headache coming on. He did not think Kuyulush cared to support the Orinatha or Princess Indergen. The grinding conflict between magical and mundial officials was being fought to shape the government of Zunith, which was evidently not a concern of hers. Minister, indeed. The other players of Zunith were, of course, the powerful nobles who dominated stretches of the world, each of them potentially the ruler of their own small stretch of ground, if the center did not hold. As an ex-Astandalan noble, or the fraudulent inheritor of an Astandalan title, Lady Kuyulush might not have landholdings on Zunith itself, in which case her future, such as it was, lay with the court. Princess Indergen had forced the surviving Astandalan generals in Solara, and most particularly the largely intact palace guard, to report to Lady Jivane as Lady Magus of Zunith. In practice, that had meant reporting to Princess Indergen herself, as Lady Jivane delegated the task of building a government to her. The Lord Emperor had been lying in an enchanted sleep, or, less daintily, a magical coma. And all the lands of Zunith, fractured from one to another by great gulfs of distorted time. Some regional units disbanded. Others rallied around local rulers, restoring order or robbing freely depending on their inclinations. Cleofer thought of armies massing, of the strain he saw sometimes in Kyrie's frowns, and wondered how far the situation had deteriorated since he was last privy to Princess Indergen's reports. He most emphatically did not want to spend his days trailing Lady Kuyulush around endless receiving rooms. The court was full of plots and poisons, and so many of them were so extraordinarily petty. 3 different youngsters were rumored to be driving towards destruction for the sake of the self-possessed beauty of the young Lady Oriana. 2 of them held neighboring lands. There were rumors of raids already. It could go beyond posturing into open warfare. Fields laid waste, towns under siege, people starving. The sickness that comes with crowding and destitution, and all unleashed by a few harsh words between overproud aristocrats in silk-hung drawing rooms. Still, these landholders were coming to Solara, now that it was possible. Court was still a draw. They were in the habit of seeing the Emperor as the center of the world. The Astandalan aristocrats still performed the ceremonies that were supposed to anchor the magic of the Empire. And he remembered the couriers he met, talking about the Orinatha's Book of Rites, of taking up the ceremonies, too. They had mentioned the High Priest of Solaris as a persuasive speaker on behalf of the Glorious One. In that one Alanoral-themed reception room, Cleofer had met both the priest wizards and the regional nobility, the centers of power, the people who could unravel the authority of the Zuni government that Princess Indergen was painstakingly constructing. He pictured it. The priest wizards, pulling the Emperor up and away into godhood, extending their spiritual authority, extracting tithes and reverence, but not, he thought, actual control. Certainly not without their magic to extend their power across the world. The local gentry, turning more and more to their local rulers, power in the form of taxes, obedience, the magic energy pooling into the hands of petty kings and princes so that each could raise an army. Would have to raise an army for defense, even if they were naturally peaceable. Anarchy. War. It was beginning already, but it was not yet irreversible. Nobles that spent significant time in Solara were perforce committed to a central authority. Once they had passed that point of disintegration, they would stop acting on behalf of the Emperor, on behalf of the Solaran government. Court would cease to be the place wars started and would become an occasional treat, a pilgrimage, perhaps, a seat of moral suasion dominated by the priest wizards. However much he hated this version of court, it was still shaping the world. No brighter future would be possible unless its power was uprooted, devolved, or contained. The next pair of guards he passed almost flinched away from the scowl on his face. Kuyulush was right, damn her. He needed to do better, controlling his expressions. Cleofer was forced to conclude that Lady Kuyulush's main interest in him was that she found him amusing. Most of his afternoons started with lessons in her silver-gray room. She put him through his paces at the court formalities, taught him the gestures and bows of respect, insult, and apology. Sometimes she taught him tricks for oratory, how to breathe, how to center his stance, how to project his voice to be heard by an individual or a crowd. She made him convey emotions on demand, anger, delight, fear, confidence. After an hour or so, she would abruptly lose interest and lead him off on a round of calls, or a reception, or some other minor social event. He would watch as Lady Kuyulush slipped herself into a different act, a glossier, polished version of herself that let no secrets slip. He grew better at reading the rooms. At court functions, his robes of office were a disguise. Many nobles were accompanied by secretaries and, as most of the great ministers of state were aristocrats, imperial service robes and hats were common. Most of these secretaries were relatively junior. He only saw a handful of other officials of the fifth degree, and he began to recognize how his presence bolstered Kuyulush's apparent status. Lady Kuyulush herself seemed to have no aim to establish herself further with the major figures of the court. Every evening, as she dressed in her formal finery, she debriefed him of the day's impressions, laughing uproariously at his mistakes, and even more so at his flashes of anger or frustration. The rest of her household remained distant, disdainful. It was easy to guess that her aide would previously have been the one to shadow her steps, that the maids were her former partners for these long gossip sessions. With Cleofer there to needle and instruct, she had dropped them entirely. He imagined she would drop him just as quickly, sooner or later. Despite everything, he could not help liking Lady Kuyulush. She was an expert reader of people, a survival skill in this strange world. She was also, he began to realize, desperately bored and lonely. One day, as she was listing off the court factions, the high nobles, the Jilkanese, the financiers, the academics, the Oranatha, the guard, the remainder of Lady Jivane's court, the high officials in support of Princess Indigen, he asked her where she found her own friends. "Friends, Cupcake." She raised both eyebrows to the disruption of the maid who was applying her court makeup. "Nobody like me has friends at court. Too slippery for the little players beneath the notice of the big fish." As he recovered from the first shock of the new, Cleofer began to realize just how far his world had been upended. Lady Kuyulush never asked him to attend her before noon, and she never took him to full court. His mornings were his own entirely. In every other assignment, he had projects, ideas, side reading to carry out. He was used to spending his days hard at work and his early evenings going over his reports, or digging in the archives for relevant material. Very little of what he was learning at court could be written down. Some parts were practical, tricks for controlling his expression, nuances and elaborations on courtly etiquette, exercises to improve his stance or manage his breathing. Other parts were potentially deadly, rumors of misbehavior, sharp personal critiques, observations about the intersection of power and personality. In the first week, he briefly reflected on the file card system he used to remember the names of his many cousins at home in the Vangavive, and then reflected further on the implications for his person if any such system of notes and names were discovered in his room. His notebook was still sitting on his desk, open to the page where he had written his core understanding, his central conclusion. The purpose of government is to steward the resources of all for the benefit of all. It haunted him. Every morning he looked at it, considered turning the page, considered closing the book. He met, in the salons and soirees, dozens of members of the government of Zunith. None of them would recognize his conclusion. For them, government was about power and how to exercise it. Perhaps one or two of the ministers who attended court events in the mid-afternoon were there for a purpose. If power was collecting with the land-owning nobles, then it was probably necessary for the Minister of Agriculture to mingle with them occasionally, to discuss weather patterns and harvest prospects, for example. Cleofer began to keep notes on the ministers without portfolios, the empty titles. He had already used the Minister of Office's records to map out the appointments within the Imperial Service. Now he added those members of the Upper Secretariat, whose details for some reason had slipped the official records. The service was extraordinarily bloated. Staffing costs were the major expense on the public purse. The upper secretariat had 3 or 4 members for every substantial role, and those without portfolio were kept on the books at half pay. The money padding all those pockets could have paid for emergency supplies for Solara against famine 100 times over. If only there was no hunger. If only... Cleofer came up against the impassable reality again and again. This rotten structure was incapable of mending the world. The government was corrupt, the priest wizards power hungry, the aristocrats selfish and scared. At least he could seek to understand the problem, to map out the solutions. He was beginning to realize that publishing his vision for a new world government, even anonymously, might be safer from a distance. His bows were improving. Laughing, Lady Kuyulush set about teaching him the obeisances required for those entering the presence. "Have you ever seen the Glorious One?" Cleofer asked. "Oh, very good, darling," she said. "Smooth as butter, not even a twitch at the thought." She shrugged out her arms, the motion setting her wide sleeves swirling. The tawny fringe of teardrop gems clattered and chimed. Not for the first time, Cleofer wondered how much aristocratic court clothing was designed to emphasize the subtle Astandalan gestures, or possibly to emphasize any errors. "The Lord Emperor is present at court, of course," she said, more thoughtfully. "On the throne, on the dais. Occasionally a favored soul is permitted to climb the lower dais, to approach the presence." She sighed theatrically. "I'm not a terribly favored soul, Cupcake. I admire the sun on earth from afar." "And I am a lowly undersecretary," Cleofer could not help pointing out. "Even less likely to know the obeisances." "Oh, I know, Cupcake. But you do look divine down on your haunches," she said cheerfully. "And who knows? One day you may be minister-in-chief." Cleofer tried not to scramble to his feet too gracelessly. "Minister-in-chief to whom?" he asked. "The Ordinatha?" Kuyulush gave him a conspiratorial grin and flopped down into a chair. "That does seem to be what they're going for, doesn't it?" Cleofer sat too, taking her cue to move the conversation to a more casual level. "The government is disintegrating," he said, too bluntly from her delighted grin. He was no doubt overly emboldened by relief that she had stopped commenting on his haunches. "Oh, Syotmdong, tell me all about it," she said, and flirted her fan into the open invitation pose. It was another challenge, so he did, at length, in full. A couple of hours and a handful of intelligent questions later, Kuyulush sat up in her chair. "Cleofer, Cupcake, what are you doing here?" He hesitated, catching himself. It had been a long, long time since he had been able to share his thinking with someone so openly. Kuyulush had surely been enjoying it. She could have stopped him at any time, sent him away. But now she seemed distressed, concerned, and he was not quite sure why. "Lord Marylow took against me," he said, which she already knew. "Cleofer," said Kuyulush again, "you want to fix the government. What the hell are you doing about it, darling?" There was a blow he had not seen coming. He did want to fix the government. "You have been teaching me," he said. "Ah, so you want to fix the court too," she said. "Put us all in our places." He shrugged. "I am a 5th-degree secretary, my lady. What can I do?" "Well, you can damn well stop going meekly where you're told," she said. "You'll never get your feet under the table like this. And I suppose you really won't bribe old Mary." She laughed. "Much better with a face, but you shouldn't stiffen up like that in the shoulders. So that's a no. She stood up and stretched, the light glittering off her dress and sending orange specks of light glittering across the room. He stood too, politely. Lady Kuyilush stepped close. She was a tall woman who enjoyed using her height to shape a conversation, and Cleofer reflected that knowing this did not in any way lessen the effect. She looked down at him with a slightly worrying smile. "Dress for court, Cleofer," she said. "Let's have some fun." Chapter 13. Evening Court. Cleofer had ordered formal dress robes months ago, when he first realized that Lady Kuyilush might ask him to attend her at evening court. They were nearly identical to his day robes, if made of far finer fabric. He slipped them from the back of the wardrobe, pulling away the strong-smelling magic tab that deterred moths. The hem caught on something. Holding the robes carefully over one arm, he used the other to pull whatever it was gently forward so he could disentangle them. It was his basket of Aphela. His heart was suddenly thudding in his throat, his head swimming. He lifted the corner of the formal robes away from the basket, then sat down abruptly on his bed. The burnt umber silk puddled in his lap. He lifted the basket on top of it. His Aphela. His wealth in the Islander tradition. His hand went instinctively to the Aphela Ko around his neck. How long had he been back here in Solara? Years, it seemed, although it was difficult to add them up in his memory. Months with the pages, surely, and then it had taken a long while to properly staff the agency for better communications, and nearly as long for health and agriculture to fully implode over their commission. At least 2, maybe 3 years? It could be longer. And since the first month, he had not thought about his Aphela. It was as though he had left that part of himself, leaving Gorjo City. His first impulse was to push the basket back down into the darkest corner of the wardrobe. Aphela were accomplishments, as recognized in the Vangavive. And over the years, your accomplishments added up to your identity. Not when leaving Gorjo City, Cleofer realized. He had left that part of himself in Astandalus before the fall. The last time he had seriously thought about acquiring a new Aphela had been over a year before the fall, when he was finally assigned to a supervisor who seemed to care about their work. He had not quite been ready on his last trip home, wanting to recognize the moment when their report was finally published, thinking also that he was beginning to make a friend. There would have been an Aphela if the appointment and friendship had both prospered, if he had finally felt settled in the palace. The report was long since buried, and the potential friendship had cooled off, and Astandalus fell. Since then, his work for Princess Indurgan, his promotion to 5th-degree secretary, would have been cause for celebration, if he had cared to celebrate when the wall of storms lay across the wide sea, cutting him off from his family. He had resigned, though, renounced his meager success in the palace. Then the long, painful journey home. No triumph there, just weary exhaustion, shipwreck, disaster. He had come back to Solara, renounced any possible future accomplishment at home, back into this muddle where he was drifting. Lady Kuyilush was right. He knew what he wanted. He spent hours thinking about it. He wanted the government to be better for everybody, the systems to be friendly, the support to be automatic, the powers to be humane. Cleofer lifted the battered old basket gently, the cradle of dreams that were too small for this broken world. Tears started in his eyes. He blinked them away, mindful of the silk of his robes. Lady Kuyilush was right to ask what he was doing drifting around the drawing rooms in her wake. He could stay with her. She would tire of him in time, of course, but he did not think she would dismiss him, not when the Imperial Service was paying his salary, and when she could tactically bring him along, when she needed that extra weight from her position. He would have a great deal of free time, enough to finish drafting his plans for the future of Zunith, enough to write and compare all his thoughts with his friends from home, and then slip away before the publication, perhaps go looking for Basil and Alinor, hoping that his words changed the world in his absence. He could ask Kuyilush to dismiss him, Move sideways into another uncomfortable appointment, drifting across the Imperial service would bring novelty, a stream of problems to solve. If he stayed an anonymous fifth-level secretary, he could have some impact. The couriers, the pages, the communications agency. Perhaps they were not perfect, but he had made them better. It would be satisfying to keep annoying Marylow, and perhaps there would be opportunities to undermine him. Though the Orinatha might well sweep his work aside with the rest of the remnants of the Imperial service, if they could dislodge Princess Indergan. He could start caring again. Not just raging in his rooms, or designing the perfect solution on paper, where all his fine planning was just beating the air. He could look for leverage, seek promotion, lay the groundwork for the future. Make it possible for those who came after him to go one step further, and their heirs to go further still. Take hold of his anger and channel it. Hold the fire. He was at Ndang. However little that meant here, he held the fire. He did not run from its burn. The sound of the palace bell brought Cleofer back to himself. He was standing with his basket of Aphela clutched close to his chest, the silk court robes of a fifth-degree secretary in an untidy heap around his feet. There was plenty of time. Lady Kuyalush took at least 2 hours to dress for court. He placed the basket neatly on the bed, wiped his eyes, and resecured the robes. As he shook them out and started dressing, Cleofer felt his mind slowly engaging with the problem. Every time he had been shipwrecked, he had danced the fire, and the songs of his ancestors showed him the way. This could be the same. He had been thinking in terms of his vision, of where he wanted to get to. Knowing your destination was necessary, but every ke'ea had a start as well as a finish. He had learned, and learned again, the importance of knowing where to begin. The last few years had taught him that. He began as a mid-level official in the government of a world smashed down to its essentials. He began at a time of great uncertainty, where many different futures were possible. The Orinatha had a theocratic future in mind. Princess Indergan was attempting to rebuild past glories. The great nobles and their armies were jockeying for position, each attempting to dominate as much of Zunith as they could. The Emperor was a mystery. Although, Cleofer smiled at the thought, slipping the underlayer of the robes over his head, he did not want his people to starve. All of them were dreaming for themselves, with the possible exception of the Glorious One. None of them had a future to offer the people of Zunith. Cleofer settled his outer robes and donned the hat, which he privately thought very silly indeed. He fixed it in place with discreet pins, the way Kiri had once shown him, and regarded himself in the mirror. A plain, ordinary sort of face. A figure perhaps a little gaunt, hard-edged, tired. Robes that looked well enough here, but would no doubt fade into insignificance in the throne room. The purpose of government is to steward the resources of all for the benefit of all. He raised his hand to his Aphela Ko. He began with a dream that was for everybody. The next question, of course, was how to get there from here. It was abundantly clear that the current government, corrupt, bloated, divided, ignored, was in no fit state to fix the world. The Orinatha's vision was inward-looking, pulling wealth and devotion to the center. They must be stopped. If the nobles raised their banners and Zunith descended into anarchy, the bloodshed would continue for decades, perhaps generations. Each would create their own governments, based on the principles of rule by force. Princess Indergan was reconstructing a functioning world government. She had restored order after the fall and integrated Lady Giovanni's household into the remnants in the palace, preventing the remaining generals from staging a coup. She had lost ground now that the Orinatha had a living god to promote, and was struggling to control her own bureaucracy. Also, her vision was too small, too focused on the past. Zunith did not need a new Astandalos. Zunith could do better. Cleofer could do better. He reached Lady Kuyalush's rooms afire with resolution, As he sat waiting for her to finish dressing, it did not so much ebb away as curdle. He could do better, certainly, but how was he going to get the chance? The Minister of Offices was throttling the life out of the service with his crony appointments and sinecures. Brilliant young people would not choose to work for a government that rewarded only wealthy and connections. Those bright few who made it through the other route would, like Lord Leofric, waste time and energy reinventing the wheel because nobody had taught them humility. Princess Indrigan could dismiss Marylow at any time, but he would not go quietly. The row would split the service, and probably the court as well. Given time, Cleofer was confident that the princess would prevail. But she would not have time because the priest wizards would take advantage of her distraction to peel away more and more of the core government remit. They would take on appointments. They had already tried. He remembered her cautious warning on his return to Solara, the wry twist of her lips. And they would absorb the ministries. The first star of his Ke'ea was to strengthen the service and reach a position where he could weaken the Ordinatha. That meant he had to find work as a private secretary, not as an analyst or communications expert. He needed to shape decisions. He needed to be close to the decision makers. Lady Cleolush arrived with a twirl, showing off her full court costume in gray and tawny orange. Cleofer stood, stepped forward to the correct distance, and bowed with the exact gradation of deference due from a client to a patron. She smiled, made a small hand gesture, and nodded as he slipped quietly to stand a pace behind her left shoulder. "Perfect, Cupcake," she said as they left the room. "Keep that baby face bland, and we might both survive this experience." The throne room of the Palace of Stars was astonishing. Cleofer had seen it many times, carrying a message to an aide, passing through on his way to a meeting, standing in the back row for some formal ceremony. Full of the lost and despairing, and the timeless strangeness following the fall. The only knot of purpose in the confused crowd listening to Princess Indrigan. He had seen it alive with the great courtiers of the last Emperor of Astandalus. Dark corners, gleaming tiles, bright mage lights, and the swirl of astonishing colors, shimmering fabrics in every shade, fluttering, draping, clinging to moving bodies of all sizes, shapes, and colors. Every single one of them gliding gracefully through the steps of the formal dances in the center of the room, or the informal dance of thrust and counterthrust, gossip and glamour that spread between the pillars, almost to the base of the dais below the throne. Almost. There was something about the impassive watchfulness of the guards, the glint of their spears, which demanded a certain amount of distance and respect. Cleofer's silk robes were dowdy here, where a hollow cloth shone on the shoulders of the most powerful people in the land. His odd little conical hat was nothing on the great headdresses of the courtiers, bedecked with jewels. After weeks of practice, he found that he could, indeed, follow Lady Cuyulush at a steady, respectable distance, holding himself ready to slip into a conversation at her signal. He could feel his hackles rising. These people, these beautiful people, who were somehow also the inevitable powers of the world. How many of them had ever felt a moment's concern about where their next meal was coming from, or spared a thought for the crafters whose long hours of labor fashioned their robes and their jewels? Then Lady Cuyulush turned her head, caught his eye, and he remembered her story. How much did he know about the lives behind these carefully made-up faces? She led him assuredly down one side of the hall, exchanging brief greetings as they went. Cleofer felt some tension relaxing as she maintained correct, short encounters. He was confident that his presence was noted, but as long as Cuyulush did not introduce him, he was free to follow her and soak in his surroundings. There was a great deal to soak in. Or, rather, there was one focus for the eye, and it was entrancing and endless. Every line, every shift in color or tone, every aspect of decoration and ritual drew the eye to the throne. The motions of the courtiers deferred in symbol and gesture towards the Lord of the Rising Stars. The shape of the pillars and the images depicted on every wall turned their faces to the sun on earth. Cleofer, looking at the blaze of gold and glory, felt dazzled. The person of the Emperor was,
a long way away up there on the throne. A dark figure wrapped in shining robes, remote and impersonal. His expression, as far as was visible, bland and benevolent. It was difficult to reconcile that glorious idol with a person who had asked whether the people of Solara had what they needed, whether his report was ready, his city fed. The islanders did not really do majesty, Cleofer thought. Then, a few moments later, he thought that they did majesty differently. In the singing of the waters, the whole islander community came together in performance, entering into the lays of their ancestors. That was majesty shared, enacted, embodied. Here in Solara, the community looked to the throne. In the Vongavive, they looked to one another. Their progress slowed as they reached the midpoint of the room. He was nearly caught out the first time Lady Kuyulush greeted a courtier with a full bow, as an equal and ally, but just managed to sweep down after her into his proper subsidiary bow. This section of the crowd was full of the upper secretariat, he realized. He recognized Lady Angusta, and the largest cluster of people orbited the slight, elegant figure of Princess Indrigan. Lord Marylow would no doubt drop into this crowd at some point in the evening. Lady Kuyulush kept to the outskirts and greeted several people he did not know in quick succession. "Minister," Kuyulush trilled to one after another, "how are you?" They replied noncommittally, politely, and a half step behind each, a secretary in burnt umber silk nodded correctly, if warily, to Cleofer. He felt strangely disconnected from his emotions and from the scene, as though he were watching from above as his most senior colleagues greeted Kuyulush with amusement or disdain. He did not realize Kuyulush had a destination in mind until she reached it. In an alcove at the back of the crowd, she bowed to a short, neat little man, somewhat swallowed up by his robes of office. "Eerie," she said. "How marvelous you look tonight." She swept up out of the formal bow and took his arms in greeting, then stepped back and angled herself so that Cleofer was included in the conversation. "May I present my secretary, Cleofer Ndong?" Cleofer swept down into the deep, respectful bow. Some part of him was distantly amused and rather thankful that she had chosen this dim corner to put him through his paces. "Isn't he gorgeous?" Lady Kuyulush stage whispered. "A fine specimen of an undersecretary, fifth degree, as he will tell you, and also, I believe, one can deduce from the hat. Cleofer Cupcake, this is Lord Iridus, an utterly dreadful man who will try to talk to me about the balance of trade, but has many redeeming qualities." Lord Iridus nodded with what Cleofer recognized as a generous degree of respect and said, "Always a pleasure to do work with your office, Lady Kay." In a surprisingly deep and resonant voice for his small frame. This was as much a joke as the rest of Kuyulush's entire appointment, evidently, from the sardonic tone. She brushed it aside and took Iridus's arm, gesturing to Cleofer to stay put. Relieved, he stepped back slightly to the alcove and watched the pair of them promenade together towards the dance floor. Their strides matched, for all that Lady Kuyulush was nearly a head taller than Lord Iridus. In a moment, they had plunged together into the dancing, and in a quick glimpse, before they were lost in the crowd, he saw that they knew one another and knew the steps well. Left to his own devices, Cleofer felt himself recovering a little from that dreamy, detached state. No aristocrat would lower themselves by speaking with him directly, nor would they risk giving him an order when he was obviously here in attendance, unless they were very sure they outranked the person he was attending. He was secure in his insignificance. Every step, every conversation here was a negotiation of some kind. He watched as Lord Marylow arrived in the throne room and became another center for the crowd, collecting a knot of admirers almost as large as Princess Indrigan's. Naturally enough, as Princess Indrigan navigated the ship, but Marylow picked the crew. For a while he watched his secretarial colleagues, some hovering behind their ministers, others drawn into deferential conversations, others waiting like him for their boss to return. Attending evening court was one of the perks of the private office work for many,
In Astandalus, those undersecretaries would mostly be aristocrats themselves, the sons and daughters of the powerful ministers they shadowed, learning their trade. Since the fall, every effort was being made to maintain the illusion of changelessness. But the faces were different. Older, a lot of them. Fewer wearing the colors and bearing typical of the great families of Astandalus. More upstarts from Zunith itself. Eventually, of course, the whole effect of the room and motion did its intended work, and drew his eyes again up to the golden figure on the golden throne. The last emperor of Astandalus, the Lord Magus of Zunith, the sun on earth, the glorious one, the Lord of the rising stars. Graceful, still, serene, looking out over the crowd of his courtiers from a distance the priest-wizards proclaimed safe. Cleofer had, of course, heard the stories. The taboos on the person of the emperor were not mere ritual. To approach the sun on earth was to approach a fire that could burn through flesh and bone alike. If you survived a mistake, the Orinatha might well execute you anyway to preserve, well, they would say the balance of magics, but he could see well enough that it preserved their own authority, too. At the center of the light, at the center of the majesty, a dark, beautiful figure of a man. The emperor was sitting with still serenity, separate from but enabling the entire courtly dance. It must be strange, sitting there with an invisible 15 ells barrier of silence and respect, watching all this susurration of silk and gossip from above. A small, treasonous voice at the back of his mind wondered if the emperor was bored. Cleofer was so lost in contemplation that he nearly missed Lady Kuyalusha's return. He managed not to jump, and was only a breath or so late, sweeping down into the proper greeting. "And here he is. Isn't that color atrocious, Eerie? You can't do anything about it, can you?"
"I am a junior trade minister, my lady,"
said Eridus, with a sort of weary tolerance.
"My remit is financial reporting."
Kuyalush waved this away, winked at Cleofer, and said, "What a shame. Poor Cupcake here is only in my office because he pissed off old Mary quite spectacularly. I would love to help him out." Lord Eridus turned to Cleofer with greater interest.
"Really? What did he do?"
Cleofer bit the inside of his cheek and forced himself not to answer. They had not invited him to join the conversation they were having about him, right in front of him. He felt his face heat. Lady Kuyalush had been eloquent on the subject. "I can get away with bloody murder, darling, because the court expects it from the Lush Kuyalush. You are a cherub-cheeked official below their notice. Do not risk directly challenging their expectations, Cupcake. It makes them dangerous." Lady Kuyalush took Lord Iridus's arm again, signaled to Cleofer to follow, and led them both towards the exit. "Oh, Cleofer was off doing something or other for the dragon when they were handing out appointments and he missed the boat. Or something like that. Her High and Mightiness told Mary to find him a job, but Mary's been digging his heels in." Lord Iridus gave Cleofer another appraising look.
"You were in Princess Indrigan's private office."
"Yes, my lord," Cleofer said, hardly even needing Kuyalush's emphatic little gesture behind Iridus's back to get him to stop there. He had no idea what she was up to.
"Isn't he marvelous?" she gushed. "Apparently very good with numbers or tables or charts or something like that. I've been teaching him how to make his bows. It is delicious wandering around with a fifth-degree secretary to rub all those snooty noses in."
They passed out of the throne room into the bright central corridors of the palace. Lady Kuyalush led them into a side room, where there were drinks and games of chance set out to refresh those aristocrats who had tired of evening court. Lord Iridus perked up at the sight of the card tables. Cleofer, who was beginning to understand what the worm feels like on the hook, was not surprised when Iridus asked him a few searching questions about his career. He was surprised, a couple of hours later, when Kuyalush gave him a wicked smile and wagered his services on the last hand of cards. When Iridus accepted and won. Cleofer returned to his room, as dazed as if from an evening of heavy drinking. He could not quite believe that he had been wagered in a game of chance. The next morning, however, her triumphant aide delivered his letter of release from Lady Kuyulush, his letter of appointment to the Ministry of Trade, and an unsigned, handwritten note in sprawling purple ink that read, "Go get them, Cupcake."